Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
On this episode of Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, we continue our conversation with Andy Schwartz, sports economist and co-founder of the HBL, the Historical Basketball League.
The Historical Basketball League is the first national basketball league for college students that will substantially compensate college athletes based on their athletic ability beyond just a college education.
And this startup league is focusing right now on HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, as a financial opportunity for these institutions that often get the short end of the stick in the big business of college revenue sports. It sounds like a great opportunity, right? But they're facing some barriers, and that's what we're going to talk about on this episode. Some of the hurdles they've got to jump to get this thing off the ground. So it seems to me the kind of behemoth out there in the fog that is waiting to get you will be the NCAA, you know, because this could catch on. I mean, this could be something that really, you know, kind of shows the fraudulent character of the collegiate model. So you get this league going, you start with a big splash, and the NCAA reacts. Like, what do you kind of, how do you foresee that playing
out? I love how you skipped over all the hard stuff.
We can get back to that if you want to.
I would love to have this problem. Okay, so first of all, we are structured as a club sport. Club sports are not, I hate to even use the verb govern, but they're not under any even claimed authority of the NCAA. Our schools are simply educating 12 men who have a great summer job. They don't have to give up their varsity team that's in the NCAA. There are on the order of two dozen D1 HBCUs.
But wouldn't these players be ineligible?
Our athletes will be, not because of anything that we say, but because of the NCAA's rules.
Right.
The moment that they receive a paycheck from us, they're no longer eligible to play varsity sports. Right. But our schools can have a separate cohort of men. We hope to eventually have women's basketball, too, but we're starting with men. A separate cohort of men, and those men's eligibility is not in any way harmed any more than, like, at Kentucky right now, John Wall, when said he's going to go back and study in the summer. Mm-hmm. The fact that there's a professional basketball player on campus at Kentucky doesn't make the Kentucky incoming freshmen, there probably aren't any sophomores, doesn't make them ineligible. And we think we're the same way. And so this is putting on my antitrust hat, where I get to pretend that I'm a lawyer even though I'm not. It would be the most amazing lawsuit, for me anyway, if the NCAA, after being in court all the time and saying, you know what, this is the way we do it, and if you want to pay athletes, go ahead and start your own league. And then somebody actually called their bluff on it, and they're like, well, we have to crush this before, I mean, this upstart of really, really poor schools before they threaten our monopoly profits. I think that it would be a position that hopefully their antitrust lawyers would advise them, why don't you just let them take their little niche of the market? So, now I'm counting on the fact that the NCAA, leave aside their legal strategy, as an entity, if you want to talk about a slow-moving behemoth, they make battleships look nimble, and we have a season, and everyone goes, whatever. We have two seasons, and people start to get a little nervous. I think that unless the NCAA is a very different organization in a year or two, and I suppose that's possible, that we have 5 years to really build a brand before the ACC says, we are tired of this.
Right.
There are schools playing in our backyard, and people who should have been going to Duke in North Carolina are going to Fayetteville State, and that's just wrong. And hopefully what they'll do is the good old American thing is that they'll outbid us. But like I said, I'd like 5 years so that we can establish a brand, because I'm just telling you this, if you're out there, Duke, and you want to kill us in our infancy, start paying your players now.
Right.
Because you have a brand advantage now, but we think in 5 years of being on TV all summer and people saying, yeah, that's the cool league, that's the cool new league, they have these great brands and really hip schools, and like that, it will seem stodgy to go play for Coach K.
Yeah.
and so a couple other things. NBA rules, shot clock, 24-second clock, NBA three-point line. It's going to be a better way to showcase your talent if what your goal is to play in the NBA. We are going to start with around 12 teams, we hope, and we want to make sure that every team has at least three, like, draftable athletes. So every game, it's not going to be like when Duke plays Presbyterian. It's going to be... It's going to be a NBA scout should watch every single one of our games, because it's going to be somebody who could be playing in their league next year or 3 years from now being guarded by somebody else who's also going to be in the league. And so we think it's going to be a better pre-professional program and also a better product. And so at that point, yeah, I'm going to, you know, if I'm in a living room trying to sell the HBL and somebody from, you know, Coach Calipari is there, and the SEC has unleashed him and said, spend what you want, he may be able to catch up. But I don't know if he'll be able to pass us. I think we will be at a spot at that point where we'll be, you know, 5 years is an eternity in the 21st century window of people's memory. So we hope to build a brand and survive that. But if it comes to the others, if they try to shut us down, I think that they'll have a lot of legal trouble.
It seems like, too, as I listen to you, this is a really important cultural moment for this to emerge, because there is so much kind of in our culture right now just about people of color finding their voice in a way that has a collective, like, you know what? We're tired of this. We're tired of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. We're tired of white dominant institutions. We're tired of trying to act like everything is okay in this country, because it's not. And it seems like just a really great cultural moment to say, well, shoot, let's do it a different way, that centers the voices of people of color and, you know, creates advantage for people of color and institutions that have traditionally served people of color. It seems like a really good time to do that. And I wonder if you could speak just a minute to the complexity of the fact that you are a white man,
right,
kind of driving some of this. And
right.
How
well,
that
so
could create
one glib
its own
answer.
Complexity.
I have one glib answer, which is that all of the basketball, all the league commissioners are short Jewish guys. it's not totally true, but, you know, David Stern, no one had any problem with him running the NBA, Adam Silver. But, and I'm not even running the league. I'm really, in some sense, like our evangelist. It's an issue. So I have gone into meetings with presidents at HBCUs, and there was clearly I didn't expect the people mm-hmm. to be in this meeting to look like you. Mm-hmm. And we get over that. The HBCUs, in a general way, have been screwed by other, you know, carpetbaggers coming in mm-hmm. and claiming to have a solution to all their financial woes. So there's a wariness that we have to get past. Now, the good news is we have seven people on sort of our executive committee, for lack of a better word, and it's majority African-American. It is majority male, but, you know, we're working on that. And the zeitgeist in our culture is such that I feel like racism is a huge problem in our country, but in some sense, I feel like some of it is a generational tension. And it's ironic because the baby boomers, who they're this, you know, the 60s protest movement and really the first civil rights generation, but something has happened. And so all those people got old and and dumb about race. And, and maybe they were always dumb about race, but they talked a better game. It just feels like they've kind of come out of their, you know, their racist closets. I have skin privilege, right? I am pink. I don't try to deny that. It's like you have to live your life well, and I don't think I need to deny the fact. Like, not only that, my parents are rich, so like I've had all sorts of privilege, and I grew up. I went to Stanford University, like all these things. Like, I also think I'm a hardworking, smart person who deserves success. I just don't think that means that. None of that came from the fact that I already started off like halfway between second and third base. Mm-hmm. And so if you recognize that and you say, okay, well, what am I going to do about it? So, you know, I'm in my 50s and I've had about 20 years of being going from being brand new at what I do to being getting good at what I do. And now I'm really experienced at what I do. And it's time for me to sort of turn around and say, what do I want my personal legacy to be? And it's like, so far I haven't really, so far, I've raised a family. I've done good sort of personal things, but I haven't really changed the world. This is a little way for me to change the world. And if it means that when I go to a meeting once in a while, somebody says, I don't trust you because of your skin, it's about time that I experience sort of experience what
sure.
every single person who gets pulled over by the cops and asked to show their license because they were guilty of driving while black experiences all the time. I don't know. Do you know who Joseph Cooper is? He's a professor at
yeah.
the University of Connecticut.
We know
and
Joey.
He's involved.
Yeah.
He's involved with us. He's on our advisory board. And I talked to him and he like just laughed at me like, you know, like you don't even know the eighth of it.
Yeah.
And so there's that piece. And then in terms of the zeitgeist, there's all sorts of things happening. So one, I agree with you. I think that this younger generation is really ready for this. If you look at like who watches the NBA versus who watches NCAA games,
yeah.
the NBA skews much more racially diverse, much younger. People are fully comfortable with LeBron James having an opinion, except for someone like Laura Ingraham. Also, at the exact same time, the way people consume sports is changing completely. So I was a fan as a teen of the USFL. There was a Boston team. I grew up in the Boston area, Boston Breakers. The Breakers, and my dad and I were among the very small number of season ticket holders. The USFL had one advantage. They were young and an upstart, and they were willing to pay more than the NFL was. But the NFL was willing to fight back. We don't have that problem because we are willing to pay young and willing to pay more, and our competitor has tied its hands behind its back and said, nya, 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 we can't do that. And so we think we have 5 years before they wake up to that. But then at the same time, the USFL had real trouble cracking the TV market because the NFL had, at the time, NBC and CBS tied up and ABC half tied up because of Monday Night Football. ABC was willing to put the games on, but it was very hard. And ESPN was just in its initial years, so it wasn't a very viable thing. Now, we've gone through the whole booming of cable sports, and now we're entering into a streaming era where
there's a lot of almost different ways anybody to watch games.
There are different ways to watch games. And so these young people who are less racist and more about, you know, like, we don't really care what you look like, tell us what you can do. They also watch all their sports on their screens in their hands. And so we can meet that audience in a way that doesn't involve having to sort of fight through a gatekeeper of like, well, I'm not sure that right. our audience can really tolerate this sort of product. We can just, you know, either we're going to partner with somebody and just throwing out names. None of these are like, you know, like a YouTube TV or a Hulu or a mm-hmm. Even a Facebook, or we're going to do it ourselves. And either way, it's a great conjunction between where
yes.
technology is going, where society is going, and who our audience is.
So where is this league in terms of starting? What's your timetable?
Our official statement is 2019 or 2020, but every day that goes by and we have not yet announced a full roster of schools, I think that it's fair to say that 2020 becomes a higher probability. We have had negotiations, both sort of initial and then really, really nitty-gritty down to the details levels. We have yet to have a school willing to let us say their name. And so this is what you were talking about the lurking specter out there. The
yeah.
The specter of the NCAA is much scarier as the monster under the bed than if we actually peek under the bed. I don't think that they can do anything, and I don't think they will do anything for many years. But like a D1 NCAA school, they get about $1 million a year from the NCAA, and we say we're not threatening that. And they're like, yeah, well, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. Now, it's an easier pitch with a D2 school. They get about $40,000 a year, and I'm willing to hand them that. Here you go.
Right.
But NAI schools. So there are some great HBCUs. I don't know. Fisk University is in downtown Nashville.
Yeah.
And they were founded in 1866. It's like a classic HBCU story, a great school. And they're in the NAIA. So they joke that they think that their gym was maybe built in 1866. It's a tiny little thing, but we kind of like that. That's like the Fenway Park of what we want to be.
I've been there.
For them, it's much more about not wanting to be a school like that. I don't want to single anybody out. Not wanting to be sort of out on an island as school number one. So it's about getting critical mass. So we never thought we were going to launch in 2018.
Right.
But 2019 is possible, but I think we're looking at 2020, and it's a matter of getting... We're obviously going to be asking our athletes to take a huge leap of faith.
Right.
But we can't even ask them to do that until we can tell them where they're going to go to school.
Is one of the ways the NCAA fights back is the fact that Texas Southern and Grambling have football as well. And if they do this in basketball, does the NCAA hold over their heads, well, then every other sport that you have that is under the NCAA reign, we can penalize?
I mean, you know, so they like to say this, they're a member-run organization. They can have a vote and do whatever they want. I just think, again, without having a law degree, that they would be at serious peril if a school said to them, we don't want to leave. We have a basketball program. Our varsity program is amateur, and we also have some people participating in this other endeavor. I just don't think they would go there. But to your point, if you know that I have a baseball bat, and even though I'm the kind of person that would never swing it in anger, if you think I might, you might feel intimidated even though I'm not actually threatening you. And so I think that's where we are.
It's interesting. Our son is a rugby player and is going to play rugby at Arizona. And rugby on college campuses is a club sport, doesn't have anything to do with the NCAA. And Marcia and I talked to the director of USA Rugby, and they were talking to the NCAA, and we just begged them to keep away from the NCAA, stay out.
There are a couple of sports that aren't super popular, but collegiate cycling and collegiate fishing that are professional college. Well, it's not that they're professional. They're open in the same way that the U.S. Open can have amateurs and professionals. So actually, people make good money as college fishermen on the fishing tour, representing their schools. And nobody says that those schools' football teams can't play anymore. So
well,
obviously,
the same with rugby. Those players play professional ball in Europe and stuff in the summer, and
great,
and it doesn't threaten their NCAA sports.
Right. I didn't know that actually. So that's good to know. So even though they're not being paid to play for Arizona, they have no problem with them playing the exact same sport during the summer professionally.
They can go and come back even.
In fact, the coaches would be jacked if you got a chance
to go play in New Zealand
Australia.
Play against the five, there's like, what, the five nations out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The only difference, obviously, is that those are not an economic threat to the NCAA's sole source of income, which is its $1 billion or so that it gets from CBS and Turner.
Right.
And we would be, because people will tell you it doesn't matter who's in the Duke uniforms. People watch for the front of the jersey. But I guarantee you that if we take all of the McDonald's All-Americans, which is really probably a little bit unrealistic, but imagine we did for 3 or 4 years in a row, that CBS and Turner would come calling and say, are you guys going to deal with this? Mm-hmm. Are you going to start competing? Because we don't want to broadcast you if they've got all the good players.
So I mean, you've got to be simultaneously trying to cultivate some serious money to do this, right? I mean, you probably can't tell us exactly who you've got in the hopper for that, but how are you kind of marketing this, not just to the schools, but to potential investors in this?
I have learned a ton about the venture community. You know, my firm that I co-founded, my economic consulting firm, we did it all with our own personal savings. So we didn't really ever have to go and do an elevator pitch to anybody. I'm getting a great education. That's actually something I love about this project, is I get to go to a lot of schools that I've never seen before and learn. I've learned so much about the history of the HBCUs. And I'm also learning so much about Silicon Valley and LA venture capital firms. And angel investors, and the sort of people that are social investors, where they want a good return, but they also want to make sure they're making a difference in the world. If anybody's out there listening, and they have a big bank account, we still need investors. We are by no means closed. We have we're in the process of trying to raise something on the order of $3 million for a. I have to apologize. I can't remember all of the terminology. We went from an angel round to a seed round, I think. This is the difference between an economist and a businessman. it's like, there's money. You know, assume that money comes in. But the good news is people who are about investing in something that doesn't exist yet are actually way better, I think, at envisioning past the bottlenecks than, for example, like a college athletic director, just as an example.
Right.
A college athletic director probably knows very well what he knows, but his job is really not to think about what happens if the rules change completely.
Right.
This, when we talk to athletic directors, there oftentimes there's like the look of shock, like, wait, if you pay them, they can't play college sports anymore. I'm like, well, they can, just with us. So investors get it, but investors look at things and they go like, schools are hard to work with because schools have committees, and we want to be fast, so we have to solve that problem for them. There aren't any HBCUs outside of the Southeast and the border states. What are you going to do about that? So we're working on plans to solve that. It's much more business-like. The doubts are real. I don't think the doubts that the schools have are false. It's just that I feel like there's only so much I can say. If it's an irrational sort of fear of the NCAA, there's no answer to that. So we're getting put through our paces. We had one VC firm say to us, we want to be the second $2 million in and go through these steps and do this stuff. And I was like, couldn't you be the first and the second? But they said no. And so we are, you know, we get five-figure investments from angels, and that's enough to push things forward. And we're looking to get to the point where the checks have eight figures or nine. What we have said is that we want to have 2 years of completely investor-funded operations, even though we're going to be generating revenue, because we don't want the HBCUs to pay a penny.
Right.
They're too financially strapped for this. And we hope, by year five, to be returning money to our investors. We think this is going to be a good, solid return on investment. And not only that, but you're also going to be changing the world and changing a whole industry. You know, investors, they like that, but they still want to see the bottom line.
Right. Well, it's so exciting. I just love it. I wish we had $1 million, but we
I
don't.
Wish I had $1 million too.
We don't.
It is. So how did you come up with, lastly, the Historical Basketball League, where the
it's
name comes?
It's a double entendre. So one, the historical is because we're basing the core of our league around historically black colleges and universities, so the HB play. But also, and I don't know how many people out there know this, the NCAA had no rules that were enforced as to how much you could pay a college football or basketball player until 1956. So if you think about, especially in football, the first real sort of like explosion of football as a national phenomenon was not when the NFL was founded, but it was in the 20s when stadiums like the Big House got expanded to hold 100,000 people, and everyone wore their raccoon coats and, you know, carried pennants, and the Marx Brothers made a movie like Horse Feathers about paying college athletes, and the Pitt Panthers team refused to go to the second Rose Bowl they were invited to unless they got $500 a person. And then later went on strike because the sophomores and freshmen were getting paid less than the juniors and seniors. There was money. Historically, college sports and amateurism were not one and the same thing. They were really antithetical. And people go read the Carnegie Report from 1929. Now, these people didn't, they believed in amateurism. They were scandalized to find that some college athletes, when they finished getting their degree, also had managed to earn enough money to start a small business. And so we want to go back to that history. If you think about the, like, wealth, income inequality in America, one of the big reasons there's income inequality in America is because African Americans don't have seed capital to start businesses. I had one person ask me about reparations. It's like, reparations is sort of above my pay scale. But if we can have some four-year athletes who earn, say, $75,000 a year, we're back to the history of college sports, where at the end of your career, not only do you have a degree, but you have enough seed capital to start a small business. And so that's the second piece of why we're historical. And that fits whether we're an HBCU in the Southeast or if we end up in a school in Chicago, et cetera. It works both ways.
Too. Like I said, I wish we had $1 million that we could give you.
Well, I think you guys know some millionaires.
Thank you so much for being with us, Andy. This is fascinating, and I know our listeners are going to be fascinated and excited and be on the lookout for this really coming into its own. And if there are any millionaires listening out there, billionaires even, you know, I'm sure Andy, you know, is not hard to find, right? Andy, you're on Twitter and all sorts of places where they can track you down if they want to hop on the good ship with you, right?
That's right. And in fact, we actually have a website. It's HBLeague, HBLEAGUE.com.
Okay.
And it's nice and slick. We have all these Silicon Valley folks helping us out. So there's a place that you can click if you want to be an investor. There's a place that you can click if you want to get involved in some other way. We're hiring some interns. So if you're if you're in school now, apply.
Cool.
And I thank you very much for the chance to ask. A lot of times when I talk to people, it feels like they don't get it, and it's nice to talk to someone who already gets it and to sort of go to the next level.
Yeah, well, HBLeague.com. Check it out, everybody. You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.